Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is How U.S. Sanctions Violate Human Rights, consisting of audio from an international forum held in Washington, D.C. on December 10, 2024. The event was organized by Sanctions Kill and Americas Without Sanctions. We'll start with Sarah Flounders of the Sanctions Kill campaign. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect my own views or those of this radio station.
Now, just an opening tonight's program from the Sanctions Kill campaign. We've focused a great deal of time and energy over years into exposing the horrific weapon of mass starvation, disease, hyperinflation, societal collapse as a weapon of U.S. policy. Sanctions, also called economic coercive measures or organized violence, impact more than 40 sanctioned countries around the world. A third of the world population is in a country being sanctioned, starved, strangled by U.S. policy. And it's an all-out effort to destabilize, recolonize the developing world, the global South. It's a cause that millions are forced to migrate, desperately seeking relief. Tonight, we'll be focusing on the thousands of U.S. sanctions on the Americas, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. But we can't focus anywhere in the world without first raising our total solidarity with Palestine and the heroic resistance. 14 months and stretching 75 years. It's truly a genocide by every standard, and yet it's a condemnation that's totally disregarded. War on Gaza, the West Bank, totally funded and equipped by the U.S., and it continues because U.S. imperialism is in full support of these Zionist crimes, Democrats and Republicans, and they have been for decades, despite a global solidarity of historic proportions. Long before October 7th, in the Sanctions Kill campaign, we focused on the U.S.-Israeli sanctions on Gaza as a form of all-out war. Since 2006, when the people of Gaza dared to elect Hamas as their government. U.S. wars and sanctions today are a stranglehold on Palestine, also on Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Yemen. Actually, the largest number of U.S. sanctions are on the countries of Africa, and this is true from Libya to Zimbabwe, from Sudan, South Sudan, and Mali, and so many other countries. This is U.S. policy of strangulation. But this week, we see in the most gruesome detail the impact of 21 years of U.S. sanctions on Syria. Once a prosperous, modern country with zero foreign debt, with free health care, free education, including university, subsidized food, modern infrastructure, because they had oil resources, they were a breadbasket, and always a strong defender of Palestine. And this was the crime for which U.S. imperialism and Israel targeted them. In 2003, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, they imposed rounds of sanctions on neighboring Syria, bringing hyperinflation, shortages. Government workers, soldiers, teachers, medical salaries became worthless, not worth a dollar. And that's fertile soil for a well-funded opposition that blames everything on the government and never mentions U.S. sanctions. And this exploded, this opposition, with U.S. help and funding in 2011 in an uprising called the Arab Spring. Now, we've seen the same tactics used in Cuba, in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, haven't we? Rich countries, potentially, and resource-rich, and with great determination and energy. We've seen the U.S.-funded mercenaries and what they can do. Now, in Syria, it was really an alliance with al-Qaeda and ISIS that surged into Syria, all with U.S. and funding also from Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And it was funded to tear Syria apart with wild propaganda and the greatest amount of violence. And the Western media was with this heart and soul. It was years of U.S. bombing, destroying all possible infrastructure. The solidarity of Hezbollah in Lebanon and Iran and Russia helped save Syria and at great cost regain control of the cities. But a third of Syria remained under U.S. and Turkish control through mercenary gangs. And this was the oil and resource-rich areas, the agricultural breadbasket. And it was held by U.S. bases in Syria and still in Iraq today, and U.S. trainers and contractors in Jordan. It's a vicious policy. And the years of no heat, little electricity, old weapons, demoralization can take hold, and the lines can collapse. Right now, the U.S. is bombing Syria relentlessly. Last night, today as we meet, hundreds of bombing runs. Why? Why? Isn't the government, they say, defeated? Hasn't the Syrian Arab army dissolved? Why this massive destruction? The U.S. wants to ensure that nothing can be rebuilt. No supplies, no material. Certainly no material to war-torn Lebanon either. It's an all-out effort to demoralize and divide the Palestinian resistance. Now, as we meet, Israeli tanks are on the outskirts of Damascus. It's an all-out invasion. That's what the media means when they say this is free Syria. This is Israeli-occupied, U.S.-occupied Syria. We are confident that the resistance will be reborn, as it has time and time again in the past. Think how many times the Palestinian movement has reasserted itself after horrific setbacks, because under imperialism, there's no solution. There's only the choice of resistance. So what does all of this mean? It means for everyone listening here today, for everyone meeting here tonight, we need to escalate our solidarity with the sanctioned countries of the Americas, with the sanctioned countries around the world, because the threat is real. It's real. The impact of these sanctions, it's cumulative. It can wear a country down. And then you ask, how could the resistance break in 10 days? It's 13 years. Nonstop of war and 22 years of sanctions.
That was Sarah Flounders of the Sanctions Kill Campaign. Next is Austin Cole, coordinator of the Americas as a Zone of Peace Campaign.
Let me start by saying that after 430 days of accelerated genocide in Gaza and 76 years of ongoing Nakba in Palestine, I want to acknowledge the deep grief that many of us are feeling. I want to honor the hundreds and thousands of martyrs, and I want to give gratitude for the bravery and the resistance of the Palestinian people, the Lebanese, Yemeni, Iraqi, Syrian, Iranian people, and the resistance. I also want to name that many of our comrades right now in Gua are suffering a genocidal economic campaign in their home. They're being starved, denied power, attacked psychologically, dehumanized, yet they also stand resistant and resilient as they drop on the 66th year of the Cuban Revolution. So what am I here to talk about? First, the Zone of Peace. So we launched the Zone of Peace campaign in April 2023 to build a popular, people-centered call for collective struggle to end systemic oppression of imperialism, capitalism, militarism, patriarchy, and white supremacy in our region. And so as part of this campaign, we have six core demands. First, dismantle SOUTHCOM, the US Southern Command that's militarizing the entire region. End US-NATO militarism in the Americas. disband the U.S. state-sponsored terrorist training facilities like WINSEC, or formerly the School of the Americas, oppose military intervention into Haiti, return Guantanamo to Cuba, and end all forms of colonialism in the Americas. And then last, and why we're here today, end imperialist sanctions and unilateral coercive measures. And so our current program and our current programmatic focuses are really twofold. One, building out what we call the U.S. Out of Our Americas Network. And this is a mass-based network of social movements, popular organizations, labor organizations throughout the region, solidarity coalitions that we are trying to bring together so that they can coordinate together, collectively and autonomously, as well as conscious individuals to struggle for peace. And then secondly, to build a collective and growing consciousness as well as popular struggle against the expansion of militarization in this region through the U.S. Southern Command or SOUTHCOM, because it's with that military force that the U.S. is able to enforce these illegal unilateral coercive measures. So to get into and return to that sixth demand, end imperialist sanctions and unilateral coercive measures, let me clearly state that sanctions, as well as unilateral coercive measures, are war. Sanctions are war. Everybody say it with me now. Sanctions are war. All of us in this room likely understand this. But it's critical that we name it and continue to name the fact that the United States, NATO, and their Western axis of domination are in an undeclared war with most of the global South, as well as those of us here that are colonized within the United States. And in particular, the four nations that we are here to support, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Palestine. This focus on sanctions is critical, and I know that we are going to hear from some wonderful speakers from these nations who will share better perspectives. So what I want to do is draw out a couple of connections and add some framing around economic warfare and its goals of disrupting and destroying sovereignty in order to reinforce the US, EU, NATO, global dominance and exploitation. So to do so, let's take a quick look at Haiti and its history of economic warfare. This history includes the ransom, high interest debt for independence that Haiti was required to pay France in order to be recognized and to participate in the Western system that de-developed the nation for its first 100 years. It includes U.S. banks led by what is now Citibank taking hold of finances of the island towards the end of the 1800s. It involves U.S. Marines invading Haiti in 1915, staying for 19 years, stealing millions of dollars of gold from the Haitian National Bank, and changing the constitution so foreigners could own land. It involves the toppling of Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide in 2004 after he dared called for France to pay $20 billion in reparations and restitution for the coercive indemnity, which I might add they ridiculed him for in 2002. 15 years later, the New York Times very coincidentally came up with the exact same number when they did their investigation. It includes the Clinton Global Foundation helping to destroy the Haitian rice industry. It includes Hillary Clinton's State Department under Obama threatening action against the Haitian government after garment workers striked and demanded higher minimum wage. It includes a destruction of Petrocaribe, through which Venezuela supported Haiti and other Caribbean islands with inexpensive fuel. It includes the assassination of Jovenel Moise in 2021 as he refused to remove fuel subsidies like the multinational financial institutions wanted. It includes the CORE group right in this moment currently working to change the Haitian constitution again to allow foreign multinationals to buy and exploit large land plots. Need I go on? So sanctions and economic warfare are war and death. We must also understand them in this wider perspective because these are all violations of sovereignty and just a taste of how Haiti is a laboratory for US neocolonial rule that denies sovereignty and self-determination, executed through economic warfare and subterfuge, backed by military force. These same things and more are happening in Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua. For example, in Cuba, currency manipulations and sanctions have been critical in bringing the Cuban economy to its knees, destroying its energy sector, and making it impossible, nearly impossible, for the Cuban government to even buy food. So what's visited upon Haiti is planned for the entire hemisphere, and we ignore it at our own peril because the U.S. is piloting its neocolonial interventionism through things like the Global Fragility Act in Haiti and through building its desire to build a permanent base in Haiti from which Southcom would operate throughout the entire Caribbean and militarize the Americas. So if we understand the goal of sanctions and unilateral coercive measures as warfare to violate sovereignty, cripple self-determination, and deny our ability to assert collective dignity and humanity, then we can see that appealing to empire and Eurocentric human rights will never end policies that are designed to service imperial domination. As we saw in Syria, sanctions imposed since the beginning of the US-NATO proxy war led to the de-development of the nation and have put 23 million Syrians at the mercy of Western imperialism. Peace will not be legislated or 501c3 funded. It will be struggled for. Another critical aspect of the work of the Zone of Peace is strengthening our America's wide consciousness of our shared struggle and the need for peace in our hemisphere, our nation, and our neighborhoods here. As I mentioned before, sanctions are a facet of imperialist war, globally and domestically, which is critical because it helps us understand that Black African peoples and communities in the U.S. do not simply suffer from deep inequalities of a racist system, but we constitute an internal colony within this country. We are a captured and colonized people, and our neighborhoods and people are sanctioned. While it may be less direct, we are sanctioned and we are under siege and under warfare. I draw on the words of my comrade in Baltimore, Erica Keynes, who said, and I quote, "We see sanctions regimes in welfare applications, in food deserts, for-profit healthcare, privatization of our water, power, and internet, low wages, underfunding of public education, lack of affordable housing. All of these things restrict us economically as people," end quote. So defeating sanctions must be part of the broad fight to assert our sovereignty and guarantee our self-determination domestically and globally. We must understand that we must strive to have control over our lives, like the people of Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, like we hope for the people of Palestine. So ending sanctions domestically and globally is an imperative in the struggle for human rights. As Malcolm said, the price to make others respect your human rights is death. You have to be ready to die. It is time for you and me now to let the world know how peaceful we are, how well-meaning we are, how law-abiding we wish to be. But at the same time, we have to let the same world know we'll blow their world sky high if we're not respected and recognized and treated the same as other human beings are treated. So when we talk about peace, we are under no illusion, right, that peace will come without conflict or without struggle. In fact, like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, we understand that peace will only come through the defeat of interlocking systems of oppression. And like Malcolm said, we know that at the end of the day, achieving true peace requires resistance by any means necessary and available. And so to close out, I'm going to quote from BAPS' announcement of our North-South Project for People-Centered Human Rights, which launched this morning. I quote, "December 10th, designated as International Human Rights Day, has become a hackneyed, disingenuous ritual in which the United States and European imperialist powers, the main violators of human rights globally over the last 500 years, speciously proclaim their commitment to human rights and what they define as freedom, while simultaneously and continuously subverting democracy, starving, torturing, burning, raping, and imprisoning human beings around the world. The images of Israeli atrocities and what could only be honestly described as a savage rampage against humanity have been justified by U.S. lawmakers with the most execrable racist language that generated nods of agreement from their vile racist allies and governments across all institutions of America, finally stripped away of any semblance of respectability for the white West, while also revealing the moral bankruptcy and hypocrisy that has always been at the core of its civilizing project," end quote. And so for us to understand this and understand sanctions and warfare as a genocidal civilizing project, we also have to root our alternative in people-centered human rights that emanate and address the realities and everyday needs of us as colonized and oppressed people. For those of us in this esteemed church, for those of you watching online, from all of us in our position in the global north, we must focus our efforts on building collective, coordinated, organized power to destroy this genocidal civilizing project and build a new alternative. The destruction, de-development, and death that has been wrought on the people of Palestine, Syria, the Congo, Zimbabwe, Eritrea, Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Southeast DC, Northeast DC, Mississippi, Alabama, Cleveland, Ohio, all over the world. That genocidal project that has come for Palestinians and Gazans today is coming for us all as well. We practice solidarity because we understand that their struggle is our struggle, that our liberation is one and the same, that ethnic cleansing in Gaza functions under the same logic as gentrification and economic exploitation that has displaced and dislocated people in Washington, D.C. So to counter that logic, we must unite in an anti-colonial struggle that will break this capitalistic system, and we must build decolonial communal institutions and relationships based in people-centered human rights. That is our struggle, one we must not only be willing to die for, but we must be prepared to live for. Hasta la victoria, siempre venceremos.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard from Austin Cole, coordinator of the Americas as a Zone of Peace campaign. Next is Ayad Kashawi, juror of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism.
The International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism, sanctions, blockades, and economic coercive measures approaches economic coercive measures as inherently violent, designed to maintain economic inequality, continue the theft of wealth from the global south, and preserve racial hierarchy in the international system. Since the end of the Cold War, the world has witnessed an unprecedented proliferation of a sanctions regime, particularly by the UN Security Council, the European Union, and the United States. This is due in part to the collapse of the Soviet Union, which ended the deadlock between superpowers at the Security Council and ushered in an era of U.S. military, political, and economic hegemony, one that is now facing substantial challenges, and we could argue the beginning of its defeat. Over the past few decades, sanctions were slowly reconfigured from wartime weapons into purported peacetime policy instruments. We have found that economic coercive measures are an illegal use of force that violates the rule of non-intervention in the United Nations Charter. We have found that economic coercive measures constitute a war crime and a crime against humanity. We have found that economic coercive measures are designed to destroy the economies of formerly colonized Global South nations and make them subservient to the U.S. and its partners. We have found that perpetrators of economic coercive measures are guilty of fraud, piracy, conversion, and colonial theft. We found that the perpetrators of economic coercive measures are guilty of the crime of apartheid under the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. And here we invoke Gaza and Palestine specifically. The perpetrators of economic coercive measures are guilty of the crimes of genocide, conspiracy to commit genocide, and attempt to commit genocide under the Convention and the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Lastly, we have found that economic coercive measures are illegal under international human rights law. We see this as part of a war doctrine that Rumsfeld has pioneered. If we return to the U.S. repeated attacks on Iraq, we noticed that as the U.S. lost the war, It trended towards expanding the war to include Syria, Lebanon, and attempts to draw in Iran, entrenched ethnic and sectarian conflict among peoples who lived in harmony for centuries, and to start the policy of endless wars. The objective was not to achieve political transformation through a decisive military victory, but rather wage a hybrid war of attrition through external attacks, internal destabilization through mercenaries and proxies, and lastly, impose suffocating sanctions to starve the people, to alienate them from the forces conflicting with U.S. empire. This is precisely what we are witnessing in Syria today, after the Zionist entity was humiliated in both Palestine and Lebanon. The expansion of the attacks targeted Yemen, Iraq, and Iran. All these countries, including Iran, are brutally sanctioned with economic coercive measures. Yet the axis of resistance responded with unprecedented coordination and steadfast unity. The U.S. went back to awaken its proxies and Al-Qaeda offshoots, such as the Sham Liberation Council, the Free Syrian Army, ISIS, and even gave one to its sworn enemies a facelift to interview on CNN. These are nihilist gangs, and they are not unlike the Haganah and the Irgun that were financed by Europe to conquer Palestine and terrorize its inhabitants. As I move to Palestine, I will not speak about the ongoing genocide of Gaza now, but rather focus on the work we did at the tribunal. I lost close to 100 relatives in the genocide, but the real numbers are yet to be determined. Gaza, a sanctioned-off enclave of Palestinian refugees, is under blockade, destroyed, and 2 out of the 2.3 million people have been forced out of their homes, only to be bombed again and again in their tents in otherwise protected areas, such as the courtyards of destroyed hospitals and schools. We held the hearing on Gaza as it was being bombed on May 13th, 2023. This is well before October 7th. The witnesses had to pause several times as their buildings were being struck, targeted by airstrikes. Our two most eloquent witnesses, Yasser al-Dirawi, a human rights lawyer, and Wafa al-Udaini, a journalist, were later martyred with their families in targeted assassinations during the subsequent genocide. Gaza has been subject to a land, air, and sea siege since 2006. Every Palestinian is a target. There has been systematic subjugation against all Palestinians, and half of the population is children. In 2007, when Hamas became the governing authority of Gaza, Israeli authorities implemented the policy of total closure, restricting all passage of goods and people through Gaza's land crossings, other than tightly circumscribed exceptional cases. The closure of Gaza comes within a settler colonial and apartheid context, as well as the context of Israel's frequent military assaults on Gaza. Israeli occupation forces occupied the Gaza Strip in 1967. In 2005, the occupation army implemented a so-called disengagement plan to withdraw from one side while retaining control over the border lines with Gaza. In doing so, Zionist forces control Palestinian access to the sea and its airspace. After 2007, they imposed strict controls on the Gaza Strip, after declaring the Gaza Strip a hostile entity as Hamas won legitimately the elections. These measures entail the imposition of restrictions on the entry of goods and products into the sector, including fuel and industrial diesel for the Gaza power plants, raw materials, equipment, and spare parts. The effect of the closures on Gaza impacted medicine, impacted medical devices and imaging, access to healthcare, access to movement, and the contamination of the water supply of Gaza in its totality. I will now move and say a few words about Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. As we see the actions of Yemen in blocking the Red Sea, even after emerging of decade-long war, as we see Iraq striking targets from under the occupation of the U.S. in the occupied Syrian Golan, and Lebanon targeting the Zionist military installation along the border, as well as Iran's series of true promise operations, we are reminded of the heroic Cuban troops in Angola, who in 1988 broke the back of South African apartheid in Cuito, Cuana Valley. This little island bordering Florida was subject to so many deadly sanctions and economic coercive measures, in addition to many invasions and coup attempts. The Cuban people not only exported liberation, but also development, medicine, doctors, and innovative knowledge. One cannot understand the Cuban revolution and political economic system outside of the legacies and ongoing realities of colonialism and imperialism. By necessity and out of ideological and political commitments, anti-imperialism has been central. The pre-1959 economy was controlled by U.S. imperialism through the imposition of the Platt Amendment in 1903, which reduced the Cuban economy to a myth and sovereignty. Cuba's countryside was characterized by latifundia system dominated by U.S. firms and the supremacy of sugarcane in a plantation economy. Trade relations were shaped by unequal exchange. And then there was the degrading tourism industry that was controlled by the American mafia. After the 1958 Cuban Revolution, the transition to socialism inevitably meant the confrontation with U.S. imperialism and invasions, attempted coups, and the imposition of sanctions on Cuba. The blockades on Cuba today limit Cuba's purchasing capacity for any product or raw material if it contains 10% or more of its components or ownership originating from the United States. These are suffocating sanctions. Although Obama restored bilateral ties with Cuba and brought their respective missions to full embassies, the Trump administration reversed this opening and notably reinstated Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism and extended the sanctions that penalize individuals and countries involved in specific trade with Cuba. More so, more than 240 measures activated as part of the embargo by the Trump administration were kept in place during the COVID pandemic, exacerbating the economic health crises. There are 90 resolutions by elected bodies, city councils, county commissions, state legislators, school boards, labor unions, representing an estimated total of 45 million people demanding to lift the sanctions on Cuba. The National Network on Cuba stated that Cuba is actually a state sponsor of peace rather than terrorism. I just want to say that Nicaragua recently filed a case in the ICJ against the German sponsorship of the Zionist genocide against our people. And the Zionists are going after Nicaragua, demanding it be listed as its state sponsor of terror. And as for Venezuela, the US makes a mockery of the rule-based order. Over and over again, the Venezuelan people go to the polls, they elect their president, and the US president appoints a president for Venezuela, such as Juan Guaido in one instance, or Edmundo González Urrutia in another, all within a farcical claim that the people of Venezuela don't have the right to elect their leadership, while they steal the most important resource of the Venezuelan people, and that is the Citgo enterprise, a total market cap of $13 billion. In conclusion, the witnesses have provided ample evidence attesting to the historic and ongoing responsibility of the United States for repeated, concerted attempts to undermine the sovereignty of the peoples discussed and states through military intervention, economic disruption, political subversion, and social dislocation. These efforts have profoundly impacted the physical and psychological health and well-being of the populations, compromised the integrity of the country's political systems, and turned the institutions of the international community against the peoples. The United States bears tremendous responsibility for its criminal actions perpetrated against Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Ayad Kashawi, juror of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism. Next, we'll hear from Carlos Ron, Deputy Foreign Minister of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you for this opportunity. And I'm very happy to see everyone in this gathering and, of course, to be able to share this panel with our comrades of Cuba and Nicaragua, as we are all struggling for a very difficult fight, which is to show the world that this narrative, this constant narrative about human rights, the instrumentalization of human rights by imperialism, has no reason and has to be defeated. Because on a day like today, where we are called on to remember the importance of human rights, what we need to do first and foremost is reject the political use of human rights, the manipulation that is employed with the term of human rights to attack countries, to violate the human rights of entire nations, entire populations, to commit crimes against humanity by illegally sanctioning entire countries, just in order to make a force, coerce those countries into following what the United States foreign policy has thought out for them. We have to reclaim the term human rights for progressive, for humanist purposes, because that's really what it's all about. And I first start, you know, by saying, speaking from the Venezuelan experience, the Bolivarian Revolution, the government that is today led by President Nicolas Maduro, and the government that comes from the process started by President Hugo Chavez, is a government that is born out of the struggle for human rights, in defense of human rights. You know, when I was a child in 1989, we saw one of the greatest human rights violations in this country because, you know, neoliberal policies were enacted on February of 1989. World Bank and IMF structural adjustment program was imposed upon the population, creating difficult hardships on a population that was already more than, you know, over 50% living in some state of poverty. And it was forced to take measures of structural adjustment that created riots, where people were really protesting and trying to, you know, get food. I mean, the riots that took place in Caracas of 1989, prior to the revolution, were people going to the streets to find food, to find, you know, things that were needed for everyday life. And the response from the state, the response from my U.S. ally, which was the government of Venezuela at that time, the response from the state was to defend the rights or the privileges, rather, of the elite, of the business class, of foreign interests. And what took place officially to this day, you know, officially, the count, you know, that they recorded was about 293 people dead, but there was over 3,000 bodies that were eventually found in mass graves and other type of things. And I'm not talking about a human rights violation that is exclusive to Venezuelan history. All of Latin America has witnessed at one point or another gross human rights violations. So what are we? We are the generation that rose in our political stance against these human rights violations. So now processes like the one in Cuba, like the one in Nicaragua, that have tried to guarantee housing, to guarantee food, to guarantee access to medicine, to guarantee education, now they're criticized, or now they're being accused of violating human rights, when in fact, what we have done all along this time is try to guarantee those rights that were denied to us by the elites. You know, I was asked to speak about what we have done. And I think it's not about numbers and figures. We can jot them down, and although they may be very remarkable, the understanding that in the three generations of human rights that we have in history, the first being the elemental political rights, the right to life, and so forth, the ones that came from basically from the French Revolution, the second being the generation of social and economic rights, you know, the right to have access to food, to medicine, to housing, and then the third generation, those collective rights. Although those rights of collectivity, the rights to live in peace, to the rights to development, the rights where, you know, for solidarity to take place, we have to understand that what imperialism promotes and talks about is only the form of that first generation of rights, some sort of political rights, some sort of civil rights, which even in their own countries, in a country like the United States, there's a difficulty to guarantee, you know, the simple rights to vote, the simple rights for non-discrimination, and so forth. The countries that have started revolutions in Latin America, like Cuba, like Nicaragua, like Venezuela, have gone beyond those political rights. We have those political rights. We have rights to participate. We have democracies that have developed even deeper sense than the conventional liberal model. But we also understood that it is important to guarantee the social rights. You know, during the Bolivarian Revolution, before the onslaught of the illegal sanctions by the U.S., Venezuela had eradicated hunger. I mean, it was one of the 18 countries that had achieved the UN goals for hunger eradication. Venezuela reduced poverty and extreme poverty. Venezuela created access to potable water, decreased inequality, increased human development index, increased employment, eradicated illiteracy. All three countries, by the way, have eradicated illiteracy. We can't say that of the United States, or we can't say that of other countries in the so-called developed world. We increase school enrollment, we increase GDP, protein consumption, we decrease infant mortality, we increase access to technology, access to specialized hospitals, which, by the way, were the product in many of the cases here in Venezuela, were the products of direct cooperation between Cuba and Venezuela, showing the world that two countries can relate to each other on the basis of solidarity, on the basis of cooperation, of complementarity, and not on the basis of competition, like the free trade agreement area wanted us to do. This is what we have shown the world, that you can guarantee, and in a common effort, you can guarantee rights. Today, Venezuela moves towards a horizon, what we've called the communal horizon. Because what we're building, what President Chavez left us as the model, for our democracy is a communal democracy. This year alone, we have had two elections where people in the communes, which are territories where there's a specific democratic, direct democratic participation and organization, where assemblies make decisions that affect the community. Well, this year we had two elections where the community has chosen which project to prioritize in their own territory. See, people will talk about the presidential election, and that, of course, is an important election. It's an election where we ratified this project. But they don't talk about the elections where we have ratified the idea that the communities have a say on what their development should be like. And this in of itself is a new way of guaranteeing rights, of guaranteeing human rights. Because when you take rights down to the communal level, where you, as a state, give the support, give the resources to people making direct choices on things that they of their concern, where they can choose what is the main necessity for them at that point in time, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a school, whether it's repairing a street, then you really are allowing rights to be defended, rights to be guaranteed, because you're not just placing people's concerns into a whole void of necessities and of bureaucracy. You're actually taking decision making down to people, to the people's level, and then you're allowing the people to organize and make happen what they need to happen in order to guarantee their access to whatever necessities they have. That is the philosophy of the communes. That is the philosophy that President Maduro is pushing forward, that we in Venezuela, our popular organizations, are organizing to support. Because one thing that I think is important and also valid for Venezuela's model, and is that we wouldn't be able to achieve any of these transformations if we didn't have the combination of a strong leadership with a political will to transform society and an organized society at the same time that can take these opportunities, can take these resources, that can take these changes and actually carry out the transformation. Because you know what? The most important thing about Venezuelan's transformation during the Bolivarian Revolution in these last 25 years is that everyone plays a part. Everyone is an active participant in their own transformation of life. It's not something that comes from above. It's not something that is given. It's something that you build together with a government that has the political will to enact it. So this, my friends, this is what we defend. This is why we talk about the necessity of reclaiming human rights for the progressive cause, for the revolutionary causes. This is why we have to defeat the lies of, of imperialism that only sees human rights when it's convenient and when it's, something that is going to support their economic interests. Human rights is bringing the true defense of rights down to the decision-making of the people, to direct decision-making, and that is what we're trying to build. Thank you very much, comrades. This is always a wonderful opportunity because to be able to share this with you, because we know that part of solidarity also involves that we be able to discuss this together, and that you know that from our revolutions, from Venezuela, from the communes of Venezuela, from the revolutionary government in Venezuela, we support all the actions that you as social movements and organizations in the United States do to fight imperialism and to fight these atrocities. We know that you need our solidarity as well, and you can always count on it. Thank you very much.
Lastly, we'll hear from Dr. Samira Adri, graduate of the Latin American School of Medicine in Cuba.
You all have heard the call that it is clear that sanctions are a detrimental tool to humanity's progress, and they must be eliminated. There are just a few things that I wanted to mention. Number one, when we think of human rights, we need to understand that it's been created by a group of people historically that excluded a lot of us. It's not a surprise that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights came in the year that the Nakba started, 1948. And in that year that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was developed, much of the world's countries were not yet independent. They were colonized. So this concept of colonizers sitting at a table, writing beautiful words that are supposed to apply to every human being when they do not really and truly consider the rest of the world humans is something that we need to reassess. It has been said time and time again. I'm not saying anything new. Black Alliance for Peace, I believe the national coordinator, Jamu Baraka, has mentioned this, that we have to rework this whole idea of human rights and center ourselves more on people-centered human rights, because that's what takes humanity into account. This framework that we keep promoting, unfortunately, is very exclusionary. We've seen what has played out with this genocide. We've seen what has played out with all these sanctions from Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, all the countries that are sanctioned, Zimbabwe, Haiti, everybody goes to the UN to demand that sanctions end. But what happens? The paradigm, the framework of the United Nations is already rotten. It's already faulty. It must be gutted out. It must be reworked to include all of our voices and not just all of us who are now supposedly free, because not everybody is free. And that is why we're here. If it wasn't for the fact that the horrors of the genocide that are occurring on a daily continue to infringe on the human right to life and the sacredness of life being neglected at a gross, grotesque level, we would not be here tonight. The sanctions that we've talked about, they were explicit. In 1919, I think Woodrow Wilson was the one describing what the intention of a sanctions paradigm or concept was. It's to basically be a silent tool of death, bring people to their knees, to be subjugated, to be dominated by other peoples. It is not a tool for anybody to use to their fellow brother and sister in mankind. But yet, here we are, over a century later, still talking about sanctions and how this same concept is set up to put us against each other and to dictate who can live and who can die, who is worthy of living. The sanctions that we've been talking about that violate human rights are violations of access to everyday necessities. We talk about what's happening in Gaza, where electricity is cut off for 20 hours a day. We talk about what's happening now in Cuba, where because of resisting the blockade for over six decades, they are now having to rotate blackouts because the infrastructure is old, because the parts will not get to the island because they're restricted. They cannot do financial transactions. They cannot do this. They cannot do that because of sanctions. And so people have to live in darkness, literally. People have to live in moments of spreads of diseases that could be avoided if they had fuel to run water pumps, to clean sanitation, water sanitation stations, to grow food and to distribute food so everybody has something to eat. These are the egregious violations of human rights that are not being addressed on the World's Forum. These are what we are being held hostage to allow and tolerate. It cannot be. It cannot be tolerated because we know that right here in the belly of the beast, we are also suffering our forms of sanctions because the government decides that it is only a few who deserve to live and live well. And I, as a physician trained in the paradigm of health is a human right, I cannot give access or healthcare to somebody unless they have money to pay. That is not what health is supposed to be about. It's not supposed to be a for-profit system. So for me, I think it is very important because each and every one of us in this room and on this call, one thing we can all identify with is how health at some point in time has compromised our lives. We've been affected at some point. Now just imagine how you can intentionally deprive people of access to care in Gaza and the rest of Palestine because the occupier has to give permits to people whether they can go get a doctor's appointment. And aside from that, they're blowing up all the hospitals. They're killing people on their hospital beds, where Cuba is struggling to center its meager resources to keep hospitals and clinics running. People in their neighborhoods have to rotate in darkness just to keep hospitals running. Those doctors have to keep going to work. Even though their houses may not have electricity, they still got to go to work because Cubans, like Gazans, like Venezuelans, like Nicaraguans, who are trained in the medicine of healing, do not leave their patients to die. We have to challenge and resist in the same way Nicaragua has been resisting, despite having to deal with a history of U.S. intentionally meddling in their lives, with years of civil war that devastated the people, destroyed Nicaragua, but they fought. They fought and they won. Even when they had to lose a moment to neoliberal forces, they came back. It is our duty to support the Nicaraguan revolution, just as it is our duty to support the Venezuelan revolution, which is being so strong despite all the aggression enacted upon it. Venezuela was there for Cuba. It is because of Venezuela that for quite a while, Cuba could continue to resist the aggression of the U.S. sanctions and the blockade. But now Venezuela has to deal with frozen assets, limitations in transporting and exporting their fuel, a country that is full of natural resources. That is much of the history of the world. We come from continents where we are endowed with natural resources that are supposed to be enough for everybody to live well. But instead, we have the oligarchy running around, pitting us against each other, and devastating our lives, our environment, and our future. We must come to a point where we recenter and understand that resistance is the only way we are going to make a viable future for this world. Please. So I say, free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
And the blockade on Cuba.
And the blockade on Cuba.
And the blockade on Venezuela.
And the blockade on Venezuela.
And the sanctions on Nicaragua and all other of the 40 countries in the world that are suffering under sanctions right now. Viva la revolución. Hasta la victoria siempre.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was How U.S. Sanctions Violate Human Rights, consisting of audio from an international forum held in Washington, D.C. on December 10, 2024. The event was organized by Sanctions Kill and Americas Without Sanctions. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.